It is the night before Jesus' crucifixion, though the disciples don't understand that. They're gathered in Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. Jesus has washed their feet. He has spoken of their need to follow his example, and he has said that Psalm 41:9 was going to be fulfilled. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. Though they don't understand it, Jesus is preparing his disciples for the events soon to transpire. He is preparing them for the ministry they will carry on when he is gone. That preparation will continue in this farewell discourse that will occupy the next few chapters in John's Gospel. We've been surveying the scene from a distance, watching Jesus and the 12. And now, as if looking through a zoom lens, we are going to focus in primarily on two characters who interact with Jesus: his beloved disciple and his betrayer. This will be a study in contrast, a study that will constitute both a warning and an invitation. These two stories are interwoven, and so we're not going to have an outline. It will unfold as we work our way through the passage, but we want to study it now to learn of these things. We begin at verse 21. When Jesus had said these things, he was troubled in spirit and testified and said, "Most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." How do you think of Jesus, especially during his earthly ministry? Do you think that his divine origin allowed him to drift through life untroubled and unaffected by the sorrows of this sin-cursed world? Do you think that his deity somehow shielded his humanity from pain? Do you think that makes it impossible for you to relate to Jesus or for Jesus to relate to you? If you have such thoughts about Jesus, then this is one of many verses in Scripture that should lead you to abandon them. When Jesus had said these things, John tells us he was troubled in spirit. And we've encountered such language before. When Jesus saw Mary and others weeping in grief on the way to Lazarus' tomb, John tells us that Jesus groaned in the spirit and was troubled. When Jesus realized his hour that involved his death had come, he began crying out to his Father, saying, "Now my soul is troubled." When Jesus witnessed the impact of death upon others, and when he contemplated his own approaching death, he was deeply troubled. Death was a sign of the brokenness of this world, and Jesus was deeply affected by this brokenness. Indeed, he entered into the brokenness in order to deliver the world from it. And this was no light, easy thing for Jesus to do. It meant pain and suffering and death. And in his humanity, he recoiled from all these things. Jesus can relate to you because he knows what it is like to suffer in the flesh. Whatever form your suffering takes, physical or emotional, Jesus understands. That Jesus was troubled in spirit should encourage you to go to Jesus when you are troubled. Here in John 13:21, Jesus gives voice to what is troubling him in that upper room. "Most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." Remember, "most assuredly" with the old King James, "verily, verily," it's, I'm about to make a solemn pronouncement. Now remember to whom Jesus is speaking. He is talking to the 12. The closest of his disciples who for more than 2 years had traveled with him, had listened to his teaching, had witnessed his miracles. These are disciples who did not abandon him when a far greater number of disciples did. These are among the best friends Jesus has in the world, so it is indeed a solemn pronouncement when Jesus says, "Most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." Now, he had hinted at this when he quoted Psalm 49:1, but that was rather cryptic. How were the disciples to know what Jesus meant when he said the scripture would be fulfilled? "He who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me." But now Jesus speaks plainly when he announces that one of them will betray him. That is the form of lifting of the heel against him that Jesus will experience. And they were mystified. Verse 22. Then the disciples looked at one another perplexed about whom he spoke. There was nothing obvious that pointed to any particular person there as a traitor. The disciples looked around the table and they saw faces of friends. Friends who had endured much to follow Jesus. Friends who had engaged in ministry together. Friends who had come to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover together. Of whom could Jesus possibly be speaking? That is the question on the minds of all. And it will soon be on the lips of one. Starting at verse 23, "Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. Simon Peter therefore motioned to him to ask who it was of whom he spoke. Then leaning back on Jesus' breast, he said to him, 'Lord, who is it?'" Two disciples are mentioned in these verses. One is Simon Peter. He has already figured prominently in this chapter through his conversation with Jesus during the foot washing. Another disciple is mentioned along with Peter. He's not named, but he is simply described as one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. And this is the first time in this gospel that we encounter this phrase that points to one particular disciple without mentioning him by name. But we'll come to them again as we move on. Well, who is this beloved disciple? Well, first of all, we should note that this moniker does not mean that Jesus loved only one disciple. What it communicates is that this disciple had an especially close relationship with Jesus. We know as we read the Gospels that there were a broad group of disciples, there were a group of 70, there were a group of 12, and there seems to be an inner group of 3 that experienced even more intimacy with the Lord. And it would appear that this disciple is one of them. Consider what we learn in some future ways in which this phrase is used in the Gospel. In chapter 19, verse 26, the disciple whom Jesus loved, alone of the disciples, is at the foot of the cross with Jesus' mother. The others have fled. The disciple whom Jesus loved is there. In chapter 20, verse 2, the disciple whom Jesus loved arrives at Jesus' tomb with Peter on that day of resurrection. And in 21, verse 7, it is the disciple whom Jesus loved who in the boat recognizes Jesus on the shore and says to Peter, "It is the Lord." Now, such examples show this disciple to be among that innermost core of Jesus' disciples and to be one closely associated with Peter. In the final verses of the book, the disciple whom Jesus loved is mentioned again, and there it is said of him, "This is the disciple who testified of these things and wrote these things." Well, maybe that gives you a clue. Since we're reading the Gospel of John, you probably now conclude that the disciple whom Jesus loved is John, the son of Zebedee. And if you concluded this, you are in line with the traditional identification of the disciple and the explanation that does seem to me to make the best sense of the evidence. It is interesting that John, the son of Zebedee, is never mentioned by name in this gospel. Though from the other gospels, we know that Peter, James, and John formed apparently the innermost core of those disciples. Now, it may have been humility that led John to avoid naming himself. Then again, if singling himself out as the disciple whom Jesus loved doesn't sound so humble, It may well be that John was simply trying to put the focus on Jesus and put the focus on his love rather than on himself. What better way for you to identify yourself than as one whom Jesus loved? We can at least say that a good case can be made for John the son of Zebedee being this disciple whom Jesus loved, and that though this gospel is actually anonymous, there's nothing in the gospel that by name names its author, there's good reason to believe that the disciple John is the one who wrote the gospel that we know as the Gospel of John. Now we have a picture of the intimacy of this disciple with Jesus in the description of him in verse 23 as leaning on Jesus' bosom. And this takes on some significance in this gospel because it harkens back to the description of Jesus in chapter 118 as the one who is in the bosom of the Father. Commentator George Malakuziel, if anyone would want to guess how to spell that name, I only know how to pronounce it from my professor in seminary, but commentator George Malakuziel helpfully draws out this connection when he writes this: "The beloved disciples lying in the bosom of Jesus during the meal is similar to the prologue's presentation of God's only Son who is in the bosom of the Father. This position symbolizes the loving communion existing between the Son and the Father. Just as the Son of God, lying on the breast of the Father, was able, as it were, to hear his heartbeat and reveal his heart, so the disciple whom Jesus loved and lying on the bosom of Jesus is able to find out and reveal the secrets of Jesus' heart. That is why Simon Peter asks him to inquire from Jesus about the identity of the betrayer." Now we should try to sort of get this scene before us. Despite what you may see in some paintings and illustrations, the practice of Jesus' day was not to sit in chairs at a table. Rather, it was to recline at the table on the floor. At a special meal like Passover, one would lean the left elbow on the table, feet stretched out behind them, leaving their right hand free to eat the food. And so the person seated like this on Jesus' immediate right could lean back upon Jesus himself. And that is what the beloved disciple does as he asks Jesus, "Lord, who is it?" Verse 26, "Jesus answered, 'It is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it.' And having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon." We learn the identity of the betrayer in an indirect way. Earlier in this chapter, we had a significant action in Jesus washing the disciples' feet. And now we have another significant action in Jesus dipping the morsel of bread and giving it to Judas. As one commentator noted, in traditional Middle Eastern societies, it is a mark of special favor for the host to dip a piece of bread in the common salt dish and hand it to a guest. And thus, when Jesus does so to Judas, he is doing something that shows a sign of special favor. And since Jesus is able to hand it to Judas, it's quite likely that Judas was sitting to his immediate left. And so probably the scene looks something like this. Jesus is seated at the center, the beloved disciple on his right, perhaps Peter on the other side of him, maybe Judas on his left, and the other disciples further from Jesus. The act of dipping the morsel is significant as an expression of love to Judas, but it is a love that Judas will soon betray. It also signals to the beloved disciple that Judas is the betrayer. Jesus is the one I'm going to give the bread to. And the beloved disciple knows. Furthermore, it explains how the prophecy of 41:9, to which Jesus had alluded in verse 18, would be fulfilled. Now, though Peter had prompted the beloved disciple to ask the question, we don't know if the answer got back to Peter. It appears that the beloved disciple leaning on Jesus' bosom is the only one who knows that Judas will be the betrayer. And remember, he is the one writing this gospel and telling us about it. How would he have such inside information? He's bearing his own testimony. We read more about Judas in the next verse that begins, "Now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him." Back in verse 2, we read, "Supper being ended, the devil having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him." It's been put in his heart. And what had previously been planned is now put into action as Judas, as it were, invites Satan into his heart to walk the path to perdition. And this reminds us that what is happening here is spiritual warfare on a cosmic scale. Satan is out to get Jesus. Judas is a pawn in Satan's strategy. Though Judas, of course, is responsible for what he does. We read on, continuing in verse 27, "Then Jesus said to him, 'What you do, do quickly.' But no one at the table knew for what reason he said this to him. For some thought, because Judas had the money box, that Jesus had said to him, 'Buy those things we need for the feast,' or that he should give something to the poor." Note that Jesus is the one who sets things in motion by offering the bread to Judas and by telling him, indeed commanding him, "What you do, do quickly." Though Judas is acting through the working of Satan in his heart, Jesus is the one who is sovereignly in control of the situation. Only now that his hour has arrived will he allow Judas' plan to proceed. Think of how many times in the gospel we've seen some threat that would have led quickly perhaps to Jesus' death, and yet we're told that his hour had not yet come. It has come now, and he consents to what takes place. He is in control. Now, once again, the disciples' lack of knowledge surfaces in this chapter, but no one at the table knew for what reason he said this to him. We might think the beloved disciple would know because of what Jesus had just told him, and this could be the case, but he might not necessarily connect Jesus' words to him about Judas being the betrayer to Jesus' words to Judas about doing something quickly. Might have been something he only realized in reflection later on. Jesus had given no time frame for the betrayal. So we can understand if even the beloved disciple joined the others in their ignorance. Since Judas was the trusted treasurer of this group, they thought Jesus was sending him out to make some last-minute food purchase or to give something to the poor. That apparently was the kind of thing Judas did all the time. Another sign that he held a prominent and trusted position among the 12 disciples. So the other disciples did not understand what Jesus meant, but Judas did. Verse 30, "Having received the piece of bread, he then went out immediately, and it was night." Jesus gives a command. Judas obeys Jesus' command and leaves immediately. And the passage ends with the ominous statement, "And it was night." This is more than a mere time reference in light of the symbolism of this gospel. Back in chapter 9, verse 4, Jesus had warned, "The night is coming." In chapter 11, verse 10, Jesus said, "If one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." In chapter 12, verse 35, Jesus commanded, "Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. He who walks in darkness does not know where he is going." Judas is one who walks in the night because the light is not in him. Indeed, Satan is in him. Darkness has truly overtaken him, and he does not know where he is going. Judas is one of the people described in chapter 3 as one who loves darkness rather than light. This passage presents us with a clear study and contrast between the betrayer and the beloved. And we are presented with a warning against walking in the way of the former, as well as an invitation to walk in the way of the latter. Judas chooses darkness by turning away from Jesus. The beloved disciple chooses light by turning to Jesus. Jesus is the light. This is the clear teaching throughout John's gospel. In its opening verses, we read of the Word that became flesh in Jesus. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. In chapter 3, we read of Jesus' incarnation. The light has come into the world. Against the backdrop of the great lamp-lighting ceremony during the Feast of Tabernacles, Jesus declares in chapter 8, "I am the light of the world." In chapter 12, Jesus says of Himself, "A little while longer the light is with you. While you have the light, believe in the light, so that you may become sons of light." By deciding to betray Jesus, Judas chooses darkness over light. And his action symbolizes his spiritual condition. Judas leaves the presence of Jesus, the light, and goes out into the night, the darkness. By way of contrast, the beloved disciple remains with Jesus, leans on his bosom. By doing so, he experiences an intimacy with Jesus akin to the intimacy Jesus shares with his Father. If you have left the darkness and embrace the light through faith in Jesus, then you also are a son or daughter of the light. And the beloved disciple's intimacy with Jesus is also your intimacy with Jesus. You too can figuratively lean upon Jesus. You can rest in Jesus. You can be absolutely confident of Jesus' love for you. As you rest in Jesus, you can also be confident that He will overcome whatever darkness is in your life and whatever darkness is in this world round about. As John declared in the prologue to his gospel, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. The light of the world will prevail over the prince of darkness. John, whom I do take to be the beloved disciple, wrote this gospel, as well as some epistles, one of which we read from this morning, and the book of Revelation. And in that final book of the Bible, that book also by John, we get a glimpse into the future, including this description of some of what life will be like when the new Jerusalem descends from heaven at Christ's return. And this is what we read in Revelation 22, verse 5. And think about this in light of all the symbolism that has been established in John's gospel. This is the New Jerusalem. "There shall be no night there. They need no lamp, nor light of the sun, for the Lord God gives them light, and they shall reign forever and ever." People of God, don't be discouraged by the darkness that may surround you. The future belongs to the light because the future belongs to Jesus. Trade in your fears for the assurance of His love. Believe in Him. Rest on His bosom. And revel in the victory of light over darkness, a victory in which you have a share in Jesus.